Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the What If Podcast, powered by IntentFit. I'm your host, Quentin. Wow, we're on episode two. Episode one went about as well as it could have. However, I will say, nobody told me that recording yourself and then having to go back and edit it was so cumbersome and cringy, to be quite frank. Nevertheless, I'm stoked about today's conversation. This is an absolute blessing, and I'm excited about being here. So, look, today's going to be part two of our two-part series on the power of vulnerability. Last week, we were able to cover vulnerability as it ties into relationships, both friendships as well as romantic relationships. And then we jumped into where it ties into masculinity in today's society. And then we wrapped up with spirituality, religion, and a little bit of philosophy and how vulnerability plays a role there. Today is going to be a little bit different. I'm excited about today's conversation because I have personal experience with a lot of this stuff. Both past and present. So I'm excited about it. We're going to be talking about performance output, both mentally as well as athletic endeavors. And then we're going to jump into leadership aspirations, how vulnerability can help build trust, team cohesion, and respect. And then we're going to dive into a concept that I'm actively trying to practice on a daily basis to help with mental health as well as with self-reflection. So I'm very excited about today's conversation and excited that you guys are with me. Let's jump right in. Okay, so before we get into the meat and potatoes of the conversation today, I think it would be prudent if we covered a topic that should take us throughout the entire conversation, which is something known as the default mode network. And if you're not familiar with what the default mode network is it's essentially a set of brain regions that are activated when we drift inward into thought, as opposed to focusing on the present moment. This is everything from mind wandering or daydreaming. It could be associated with rumination as well as projection, right? Projection being that, you know, if I take action X, what will the outcome be? This is something that can either be a positive thing or it can be a negative thing. Nevertheless, it is tied to our evolutionary development. The default mode network helped us to anticipate future danger. It helped us understand how to navigate social dynamics. It even allowed us to, and still allows us, to understand what decisions we made in the past and how we can improve upon those decisions, right? There's one stat that I pulled here that I thought was really significant. We spend nearly 47% of our time in the default mode network, according to Killingsworth and Gilbert, a study that they did back in 2010. 47% of our time. That's 50% of our day. I mean, I suppose it makes sense, right? Like, you know, if you're driving, you're probably not focusing on driving completely, or your mind is wandering and you're thinking about, you know, a task that you have to do or, you know, whatever. So it makes sense. Now, although there are a lot of benefits associated with it, there's also some negative consequences to it as well. Some of them would be overthinking, right? Overthinking that leads to anxiety or depression. If you're not actually taking action on something, that leads to self-loathing. And then ultimately, I think the biggest, you know, detriment to it is that if you are somebody who overthinks or ruminates too much, you look back and realize that you've missed opportunities in your life. And that could be romantic relationships, it could be friendships, it could be career opportunities. All of these things obviously play to something that we're all trying to avoid, essentially. This is also a big part of something called cognitive dissonance. And if you're not familiar with cognitive dissonance, essentially what this is it is when our actions and behaviors don't align with our values or desires. So, for example, if I want to lose 10 pounds, that's my desire, but I don't go to the gym or eat healthy consistently, that is something that's referred to as cognitive dissonance. And when we're focused too much, or when we live too much in the default mode network, that is one of the consequences associated with it. So I think it's important that we try to identify our thought patterns as best we can, so that when we get into a vicious cycle of these thought patterns, we can identify it and we can overcome it as fast as possible. So let's get into that. Okay. The first step is you imagine fear or rejection before it even happens. Second step is that you are scared of how you're ultimately going to be perceived. Thus, you avoid taking action and then you obsess over the outcome. So the best example of this, I would say, is let's use the example of starting a podcast. I think this is something that I can relate to most definitely. Excuse me. Look, starting your own podcast can be really intimidating. And of course, there's going to be an element that, you know, I was scared. I was scared to start this podcast. I didn't know if people were going to like it. I still don't know if people are going to like it. I don't know if people are going to listen to this and think it's totally asinine and think that, you know, I have no credibility or if I'm just Joe Schmo. I don't know how this is going to play out, but I have to remind myself that these thoughts are just completely irrational. Unless I actually go forward and take the steps necessary to execute on it, everything that comes before that is completely out of my control, and those thoughts are just completely irrational, right? The second one is, how are you going to be perceived? Well, I'd like to be taken serious on this podcast. I spend, you know, a significant amount of time trying to dive into these subjects and understand the subject matter, and then ultimately try to convey that to my audience. I want people to take this serious because I take it serious. I don't want people to think that I'm, you know, an idiot. I don't want to be embarrassed. I don't want to feel shame. So, but I also am trying to think about it from the lens of, regardless of what happens, this is going to make me a better person. And so I'm going to go into it being curious about everything that I'm learning, but every subject matter that I dive into. And so that's the perspective that I'm trying to take. And I think that that is something that you can probably implement into a number of different scenarios. The second thing is avoid taking action. Well, you can sit there and ruminate and overthink the situation all day, but you'll never really know unless you actually take action. And so I went out and I bought the cameras and I got the lights and I got the mic here to just give it my best shot. And that's all you can do. Look, I mentioned it last week. I'm a big fan of stoicism and stoic philosophy. You can't always control the outcome, but you can control your attitude and your effort. And that's all I'm trying to do here. And again, you can associate that with any number of scenarios. So taking action is the only way that you actually learn and you grow. So, and then obsessing over the outcome. If I had never done this, I probably would constantly think, well, what if, right? What if I had done that? What if I had had the courage to put myself on camera? What if they worked out the way that I was hoping to? So that's a really good way to kind of think about it. And hopefully that gives you a little bit more insight into how I'm thinking about it and how I break down these cycles of thoughts that can be ultimately detrimental or negative. Leadership in building cohesion, trust, and respect. All right, this will be a fun one. Before we jump into it, I just want to say I have a tremendous amount of empathy and respect for anybody who's in a leadership role, whether that be a coach, a manager, a VP, whatever the title is. At the tail end of my personal training career, I was the fitness manager. I managed anywhere from 10 to 15 employees at any given time. I had a revenue budget of anywhere from 40 to I think it was $70,000 in revenue each month. So it was very stressful. And I went from loving my job to hating my job. When you're in a leadership position, you're wearing multiple hats, you're managing different personalities, temperaments, learning how to motivate different people based on different incentives. You are always putting out fires, whether that's an internal fire or a customer-facing fire. That's your responsibility to deal with. And then ultimately, success is the burden bestowed upon you. Either you fail or you don't fail, and you're going to be the one that everybody points the finger at the end of the day. So I respect and have a lot of empathy for people in those positions. But I've also had really negative managers and leaders and coaches in my life. And I think a large part of it is due to the fact that there is a inflated sense of status due to hierarchy or perceived hierarchy. Now, I get it. I understand that there are, you know, employees and managers and VPs and, you know, executives, and that's the hierarchy in the corporate world. Nevertheless, if you act like you're better than other people or that you have a higher status than other people, you're going to destroy your team. They're going to completely, you know, mistrust you. You're not going to get loyalty from them, and you're going to deal with the consequences of it. Retention is going to go down. Performance is going to go down. Quality of work is going to go down. So we should try to be as cognizant as we can around the traits that people resonate with and don't resonate with. So let's jump into some of those traits. Responsibility. So you can either go one of two ways with this. Either you can avoid responsibility and point the finger at everyone when things go wrong. You can say, well, you know, my team didn't show up and they didn't do the right things, and so it's their fault we didn't succeed. That's obviously going to lead to people being very resentful. You're going to lose loyalty, and ultimately that's just going to, you know, completely destroy your own self-image. Or you can bring yourself down and admit that, you know, your team didn't hit their quota or didn't hit their goal or didn't, you know, accomplish this task or project, and you are somebody that played a big part in that, and that you need to look at yourself in the mirror and reflect on it and learn how you as a leader can become better. That does the exact opposite. If you can bring yourself down to that level and have the courage to say those things or to admit your own responsibility, people are going to fall in line. They're going to be as loyal as a dog. They're going to get behind any mission or task that you then put onto them in future scenarios. Responsibility, avoiding it or accepting it, is very, very, very key to a successful leader. Transparency. I realize that strategies and goals and rules, they change. You know, particularly in the corporate world, you know, strategies are constantly changing. I can't tell you how often we had one sales tactic one quarter and then we changed it the next quarter, or, you know, new rules or regulations or ways that we managed our territories were rolled out, and managers handled it one of two ways. Either they were transparent and explained why these things were happening and tried to, you know, illuminate the benefits of it, and also admitting that even if it was uncomfortable, that the direction that the company was going was one that we at least had to give our best effort to and were real about it, as opposed to just reading off of an HR script. Those managers, again, were the ones that were far more successful in terms of building loyalty and building team cohesion and getting people to buy into these new rules and these new regulations. If you can't explain why something is being rolled out, or why a new strategy is going to be beneficial, you're not going to get any buy-in, and people aren't going to trust you, and they're not going to believe you. I think a big part of this is leading with authenticity. We as humans are built to detect BS. It's a part of our sympathetic nervous system. We listen to tonality. We read body language. We take all these things in subconsciously, and if you don't come off authentic, and if you don't come off genuine, then it's going to be pretty easily detected by most individuals. So transparency and being authentic about it is crucial. The next one is feedback. Oh, feedback. Feedback's a fun one. I hate getting feedback, and I'm sure that a lot of managers hate getting feedback, particularly from their subordinates or people on their team, because it's difficult to be vulnerable in those moments. You're supposed to be the know-it-all. You're supposed to be the person that has all the answers. And when you're getting feedback, that can be a tricky conversation to navigate. Now, in my experience, I've had two different types of managers deal with feedback differently. They either don't ask for feedback at all, or the feedback that they ask for comes off very disingenuous. And what I mean by that is that they'll ask it almost in a very HR-like tone. Well, or even the context for that matter. So here's an example. I would have, you know, a one-on-one with my manager. And for 30 minutes, they'd rip into me and tell me all the things that I wasn't doing right or the areas I could improve on. And at the very end of the conversation, they'd then say, well, what can I do better? And then they'd leave it like that. And it was an open-ended question. How can I be better? How can I help you? How can I support you? As an employee, that's not a very comfortable way of addressing, or it's not easy to give feedback if the question is open-ended. Now, if a manager came to me and said, last week we had a call with our champion at X, Y, and Z company, and I thought it went really well. I interjected and I tried to present our company values and our company, you know, the benefits of working with our company as eloquent as I could. What did you take away from that? Do you think I did a good job? Do you think that there were any areas of improvement? You know, I feel like I could have done X, Y, and Z better. If you approach it from that perspective, you're going to get so much. Again, that's being authentic. That's being real. That's bringing yourself down to their level and being a human. And you're going to get a far better response from that. Not only are you going to get a better response from that, but you're going to start to identify bottlenecks, issues that might be being swept under the rug that you're not ultimately catching about yourself or about your team or about the strategy that you're implementing. So you're going to get far more production as well as just ultimately respect and building trust, right? All these things come down to building trust and respect. The next one is setting unreasonable standards or reasonable standards. I can't tell you how insidious this is. I know that being a manager, you feel like you need to have all the answers and that you need to micromanage everybody's work. Or maybe you're somebody that has, you know, a high level of perfectionism and you want to implement that across your team. That's not how humans work, right? Nobody wants anybody to be breathing down their neck. Nobody wants somebody to pick and, you know, nag about every little thing that they do. They want to be led in a way that is inspiring. They want to feel like they've been taught the right way and that they have the competency and the confidence to execute on their own. That is what a real leader can do. A real leader can instill confidence and competence in a team and then let them do what they will to be successful. If you don't, and all you do is nitpick and you know, pick apart what somebody's done wrong, or micromanage them and make sure that every little thing gets done the way that you want to get it done, not only is that going to just annoy people and get them to be very resentful towards you, that's also going to put a tremendous amount of cognitive load on yourself. You're going to be constantly thinking about what other people are doing, or maybe just one specific individual that doesn't meet your standards, as opposed to being able to let people do what they need to do and allowing you to focus on other areas of the team or of the business that is going to lead to, you know, a successful outcome. So those are the traits that I think are the most important when it comes to leadership. And again, like, I can't stress it enough, like, authenticity is the most important thing. And one other thing that I'll call out here is every one of these kind of lead into something that is referred to as psychological safety. And the reason why I bring this up is because I came across a really powerful meta-analysis. And normally I think meta-analysis are nonsense because they're, you know, it's the data of the data. And that doesn't always tell us the full picture here. But this particular meta-analysis was so robust, it was hard for me to ignore it. So let's go into it. According to a 2020 analysis, a meta-analysis by Gallup, which reviewed 456 studies across 276 organizations in 96 countries, representing over 2.7 million employees, teams that experience high psychological safety were able to engage in up to 40% higher levels of performance with significant retention, innovation, and execution. That says it all right there. So psychological safety and building that psychological safety is super important. Okay, guys, we're almost there. We're almost at the end. I want to cover a couple of techniques that I have identified in my journey of learning the subject. There's one of these that I've been implementing in the last couple of weeks that I really, really have enjoyed doing. It's a bit cumbersome, and it takes a lot of practice. But nevertheless, the idea here is that we're improving our mental health by helping us elevate our sense of self-awareness and giving us the tools necessary to begin self-reflection at a very, very deep level. So the first technique is going to be referred to as the cognitive behavioral therapy inspired reframing technique. I know that's a mouthful. Cognitive behavioral therapy, we could probably do an entire series of information around that. We're not going to do that today. We're just going to focus on the reframing aspect of it. So there's four steps rather. The first step is that you're going to catch your thought in the moment. So if you find yourself in a thought pattern that's negative, you want to be able to catch that thought in real time. Then you're going to examine the evidence in real time. Then you're going to try and challenge the pattern, and then you're going to replace the narrative. So step one, you're catching the thought. Right? Something pops into your head that's negative. I'm going to fail. She's going to reject me. I'm not going to do it well at X, Y, and Z. Catching it in the moment, examining the evidence. Is this thought rational or irrational? Is there something that in my past suggests that I'm going to be a complete failure, or she's for sure going to reject me? Right? And then the last one is challenging the pattern. The next one is challenging the pattern, which essentially is, you know what? Instead of thinking about the ideal outcome, think about it from a growth perspective. How can I learn? How is this ultimately going to make me better, right? And reframing it in that context. And the last one is challenging or replacing the narrative. So instead of thinking I'm going to fail, think about it from a perspective of, hey, look, other people can do this. I can do this too. There's no question. This is something that you have to do on a regular basis. It's not easy to do. Again, it can be very cumbersome, but it can be very beneficial. Now, I added something else to this that I think would be helpful. I haven't done it yet, but I'd like to start doing it. If you're into journaling, is catching a thought and then recognizing that thought, feeling it, being in that moment, and then going back and doing what's called somatic journaling. Somatic journaling is basically a technique of journaling where you're going into your thoughts, into your emotions, into your feelings, and trying to identify where you feel it in your body. Are there any bodily sensations? A lot of people use this to overcome trauma. And I think that if you couple it with the cognitive behavioral therapy inspired reframing technique we just went into, it could be really powerful. So you would do this essentially by recognizing the, you know, a reoccurring thought that happens, and then taking time out of your day to sit down with that thought, evaluating the evidence, and then essentially evaluating if you feel it somewhere in your body. Does your chest tighten up? Do your shoulders tighten up? Do you feel a sensation anywhere? And then start to, you know, start the practice of reframing and building a new narrative around it. I think those two coupled together would be very, very powerful. The last one is pretty easy. I think this is a lot easier than the one we just mentioned. This is the root cause analysis. I've actually used this strategy in sales. We used to call it the 5-why technique. But essentially what you're doing is you're asking 5-why questions. So again, like we could use the example of, you know, being disrespected by other people. You know, why do I feel disrespected by other people? Why does being disrespected by other people bother me so much? And asking yourself and finding those answers to it. So let's just go through the example. I think that was a poor way of describing it. So let me go through the example that I have written down. This might be helpful. There's going to be 3 whys and 2 whats. It doesn't matter. The whats, the whys, the wins, those do not matter. What matters is you're asking yourself 5 questions to get to a root cause of something. So why am I so upset that somebody disrespected me in front of other people? Because I felt disrespected or dismissed in front of these people that I have high regard towards. Why does being dismissed bother me so much? Because I work hard and take pride in being competent, and I deserve to be heard and respected. Why does being perceived as competent and respected so important to me? Well, because growing up, I consistently had to prove myself to other people in order to be respected and heard. And then finally, what does this say about me right now? It says that all the progress I thought I made isn't real, and that what I'm worried about is being overlooked. What I'm most worried about is being overlooked. You can do this. You can practice this. The five whys is fine. The way that I described it is fine. But asking yourself five questions to try to get to the root cause is basically the ultimate outcome that we're trying to get to with that practice. All right. We did it. Episode two is over. Hopefully everything went well from a technical perspective. And hopefully you guys got a lot out of this series. At the end of the day, I think the most important thing to remember when it comes to being vulnerable is that it is truly the path to personal growth. And in order to really hone in on this skill is you have to be radically honest with yourself and be objective about what you're feeling. So I hope that this was helpful. I'm excited about next week. I kind of already have an idea of what I want to go into. I'm not going to share it today. You're just going to have to wait. Also, I'm trying to get these jokers to get on my podcast, but we'll let them take their time and find their comfortability. But with that said, thank you so much for being here with me, everybody. This has been a blast. I'm excited. I'm hungry, and I'm ready to crush it. So thanks so much, everybody. We'll see you next time.